From the heart of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., bringing compelling interviews, insightful analysis, taking you beyond the headlines and sound bites into conversations with our nation's leaders and newsmakers, all from a biblical worldview. Washington Watch with Tony Perkins starts now.
This legislation is a no-brainer for anyone who stands for transparency and America's sovereignty. It would require any convention or agreement resulting from the work of the World Health Organization's intergovernmental negotiating body to be deemed a treaty, thus requiring the advice and consent of two-thirds of the Senate.
That was Wisconsin Congressman Tom Tiffany yesterday on the House floor. As the House, by a vote of 219 to 199, approved the No WHO Pandemic Preparedness Treaty Without Senate Approval Act. The measure now goes to what some consider is the legislative graveyard, the U.S. Senate. We'll talk in just a moment with Alabama Congressman Robert Adderholt. This is Washington Watch, and I'm Tony Perkins. Welcome to this Thursday edition. Well, the analysis continues from Tuesday night's presidential debate. One area of both contrast and interest is Israel.
We must chart a course for a two-state solution. And in that solution, there must be security for the Israeli people and Israel, and in equal measure for the Palestinians. But we must have a two-state solution where we can rebuild Gaza, where the Palestinians have security, self-determination, and the dignity they so rightly deserve.
We'll talk with Carolyn Glick of the Jewish News Syndicate from Israel. While the ABC moderators and the rest of the media's self-appointed fact-checkers have turned the words of former President Donald Trump every which way but loose, they've ignored the blatantly false claims of Vice President Kamala Harris, claims like this one she made Tuesday night.
And understand what has been happening under Donald Trump's abortion bans. Couples who pray and dream of having a family are being denied IVF treatments.
That is not true. We'll talk with Dr. Marguerite Duane, Executive Director of Facts About Fertility, a little bit later. We'll also talk with Brett O'Donnell, Liberty University's former debate coach, who has also coached several presidential candidates. We'll talk about the structure and content of Tuesday night's presidential debate. Mark your calendars. Coming up October the 3rd through the 6th is the Pray Vote Stand Summit here in our nation's capital. You can find out more by going to prayvotestand.org. Well, before I go to our first guest, a follow-up to yesterday's interview with Suzanne Bowdy, editorial director for the Washington Stand, regarding the 88 business leaders who have endorsed Kamala Harris. There's one correction to be made. They are not all retired former CEOs. Hamadi Yukaya, founder and CEO of Kobani, the Greek yogurt company, is still a CEO of the company, and he was on the list. So if you like Greek yogurt, you might have to find a new brand. Well, the House of Representatives did not vote on the short-term funding measure for the federal government this week. But they did pass legislation mandating that any agreement from the World Health Organization must be deemed a treaty, requiring the consent of a supermajority of the Senate. Now, we've discussed this issue a number of times on this program. Now, Congressman Tom Tiffany's bill passed the House last night by a vote of 219 to 199. It now goes to the United States Senate. Before I go to Congressman Adderholt, trying to connect with him, I'm going to go to the Vice President of Policy here at the Family Research Council, Travis Weber, for an update on the WHO and what the prospects look like in the Senate. Travis, thanks for joining us here on Washington Watch today.
Thank you, Tony. Good to be with you.
So the House has sent over a number of pieces of legislation to the Senate, many of them bipartisan. This actually had Democratic support on this bill, but they don't go anywhere. What are the prospects that this now goes over to the Senate?
Yeah, I mean, so, Tony, we should be praying that this passes the Senate. The prospects right now, you know, it'll probably be pretty close because we can expect, reactive posture from Democrats just because there are a lot of Republicans on this bill. But as you mentioned, it was bipartisan. This should be a bipartisan issue. No American should want to blindly, willingly, and really without due diligence, cede our sovereignty to a governmental, world governmental body like the WHO. The fact is, the current arrangement between the U.S. and other national governments and the WHO leaves a lot in the dark. There's text being negotiated on a pandemic agreement right now. The subject of this bill by Tom Tiffany would require Senate ratification and treatment of the agreement with the WHO as a treaty, require oversight and proper advice and consent by the Senate, as any treaty would be given under our Constitution. But the fact of the matter is, we need to know what's in it. And it's still being drafted. Things are being hashed out ever since the WHO, the World Health Assembly, which I went to last May in Geneva. This process is ongoing, and the WHO is driving it towards the end of this year, possibly into next year. So this piece of legislation moving into the Senate is an opportunity for the American people and their leaders to say, we need to know what the United States government is being signed up for.
Right.
This should be a no-brainer.
A final question for you, Travis. When, as you mentioned, you were over in Geneva when the World Health Organization met to debate this pandemic accord. They couldn't get the consensus, but they're not giving up. They're going to keep doing it until they get it. Is this a precursor to global governance, a one-world government? Is that what we see here?
Yeah, so Tony, we see a lot of developments in the direction of global concentration of power. We've seen this at the UN for decades. So why are we talking about this? Well, this agreement, which you and we've been talking about, it takes things a step further in specificity, integrating, linking, requiring, and kind of locking in national governments to what they're calling a pandemic preparation and pandemic treaty, but locking in national governments to a requirement globally to deal with health. And we know health as a topic is not going away. We see it talked about all the time. So certainly this is a step in the wrong direction. And I do think it's fair to say it's a precursor towards more aggressive action at the global level, coming down from global power institutions, binding the U.S. and other countries to arrangements that they have no control over. They've given over control to the World Health Organization, whether it concerns health, a pandemic, or some right. other claim of interest by the global body.
This is certainly unprecedented in what the WHO is trying to grab hold of in terms of power over member states, everything from speech to health care to pandemic preparedness. Travis Weber, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And by the way, folks, you can still weigh in on this with your two senators. It's passed the House. Text WHO to 67742. That's WHO to 67742, and you'll get a link, and you can communicate with your two senators. Again, that's WHO to 67742. Need to put pressure on Chuck Schumer and the Senate to take this up and vote and make sure that the Biden administration is not ever able to bind the American people. And this would include states. You can't get away from it. States will be bound by this as well. Again, that's WHO to 67742. All right. I think we have Congressman Adderholt. Let's bring in Congressman Robert Adderholt. He serves on the House Appropriations Committee. He represents the 4th Congressional District of Alabama. Robert, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony. Good to be with you.
Appreciate you joining us today. We were just talking about the WHO measure that passed yesterday, but I want to speed forward ahead and talk about the continuing resolution. You're on the appropriations. The House leadership had to pull that back today. What are the prospects of securing government funding past the end of the year into the next Congress?
Well, I was really supportive of the speaker's proposal, which I know you're familiar with and your listeners, that we would just go ahead and push it up until after the election, let the new president deal with it. Hopefully, of course, many of us are in the category that Trump would be better to deal with that. And also that we could attach the SAVE Act. The speaker, Mike Johnson, was very supportive of that. He has been working on that. He continues to work on that. But for some reason, we had some of our colleagues, Republican colleagues, that is, that felt like they couldn't support it. And I'm just, you know, I think if we can get the SAVE Act on this, and as you well know, the SAVE Act keeps anybody who is a non-citizen, whether they're here legally or they're here illegally, from voting. And that's been a real problem that we have seen in past elections. There's been questions about it. People wanting to vote when they're here legally, and they go and try to vote and sometimes do vote. And this would make it very clear that whether you're here legally or illegally, if you're not a citizen, you can't vote in our elections.
I want to play a clip from earlier today. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries holding his weekly press conference, basically slamming the Republicans for trying to attach the SAVE Act to the continuing resolution. Clip 8, please.
They have put on the table an extreme ransom demand that they want to jam down the throats of the American people. So it's not hyperbole, hysteria, or a hypothetical to suggest that House Republicans may try to shut the government down. It's the reality.
I mean, how do they get by with making these claims?
Well, we are trying to pass a bill that, of course, the Democrats don't want to help us at all. We understand that, as you know, the new fiscal year starts on October 1st, September 30th, our deadline. And there's no way that we can, in the next 2.5 weeks, that we can pass all 12 appropriation bills. We have passed 5 here in the House. The Senate, I don't think, has passed any on the floor. As of a few days ago, they had not. And we have got to have some time to iron out these appropriation bills. And we don't need to pass bad appropriation bills. You remember earlier this year, we did that big omnibus bill or a couple of minibuses. They were really omnibuses that had split in two. And there were some bad things, especially some bad earmarks from the Senate.
Right.
And so we don't want to just push something through. And I know a lot of our colleagues, they say they're not voting for a continuing resolution. But please, I would ask them to vote for a continuing resolution if it keeps a bad bill from occurring and keeping us from passing legislation that is really detrimental to the framework of this country. And so I would implore my colleagues to say vote for CR if it's a good CR.
Right.
And this is a good CR.
With the SAVE Act attached to it. I've just got about a minute left, Congressman Adderholt. The likely scenario I see is that if your Republican colleagues do not support the CR, keeping things as they are with the SAVE Act going into next year, the alternative is going to be the Democrats are going to jam Republicans in a lame duck session of Congress at the end of the year with either
exactly.
an omnibus or with a CR with all types of things that the left wants in it. Am I correct?
That's exactly what's going to happen. And that's why you may have your congressman may be very principled and say they don't vote for CRs, but in this instance, they're voting for bad legislation that the Democrats would want. And you need to, I would ask your listeners and your viewers to call into their congressman, say vote for the speaker's CR, the good CR that holds the Democrats accountable.
All right. I would be in agreement with that. Congressman Robert Adderholt, thanks so much for taking time to join us this afternoon.
Thanks, Tony. Always good to be with you.
All right, Congressman Robert Adderholt of Alabama. All right, you heard it. We got to keep the bad from happening. All right, don't go away. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Carolyn Glick from Israel. She's going to be talking about the vice president and her comments about Israel and a two-state solution. Don't go away.
The news reflects the world we live in, but it also shapes it. Like it or not, what we learn about the world on a daily basis impacts our thinking, our worldview, and ultimately our action. So much of today's media is built on a shaky foundation that can send us hurling toward harmful ideas and hopeless solutions. Family Research Council created the Washington Stand to be a news outlet that speaks from a firm foundation, bringing you news, commentary, and analysis of what's happening in America and around the world. The Washington Stand is unapologetically biblical and uncompromisingly committed to truth. Equip yourself for the world we live in with a biblical worldview found daily at the Washington Stand. Find us at washingtonstand.com. That's washingtonstand.com.
Research has found that there are 59 million American adults who are a lot like you. There are millions of people around the country who are born again, deeply committed to practicing their faith, and believe the Bible is the reliable word of God. But that's not all. They're also engaged in our government. They're voters. They're more likely to be involved in their community, and they're making a difference in elections. The problem is that a lot of them feel alone, too. We want to change that. FRC wants to connect these 59 million Americans to speak the truth together, no matter the cost. If you want to learn more about this group and what it means to be a spiritually active, governance-engaged conservative, or if you want to find out if you are one of these sage cons yourself, join us. Go to frc.org/sagecon, SageCon, to learn more. That's SageCon, SageCon, to learn more.
Hi, I'm Georgina, an intern here at Family Research Council, and I wanted to take a moment to tell you about FRC's incredible internship program. This three-month program is both a discipleship and a development opportunity where you get to take part in truly meaningful work and help advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and our culture. This program features hands-on professional experience here in Washington, D.C., weekly biblical worldview training, tours around the district, opportunities to meet some of the country's most prominent policy experts, and more. The program also includes free housing, a meal stipend, and is available in spring, summer, and fall. If you're a young adult passionate about seeing biblical values championed in our country, as a current intern, I cannot recommend this program enough. For more information or to apply, please go to frc.org/internships. Again, that's frc.org/internships. Apply today.
To Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Hey, let me remind you, coming up October 3rd through the 6th, Pray Vote Stand Summit here in our nation's capital. You can find out more by going to prayvotestand.org. So during this week's presidential debate, Vice President Kamala Harris reiterated her support for what is referred to as a two-state solution in Israel, which would transfer the geographical heart of the state of Israel, Judea and Samaria, to the Palestinians. Now, her pledge comes not only in the wake of October 7th, which has led to a soon-to-be year-long war, but just this week. In fact, in the last several weeks, we've seen increased terrorist attacks in Judea and Samaria. Is this not rewarding terrorism, which will simply lead to more deadly attacks? Joining me now to discuss this is Carolyn Glick. She's a senior contributing editor at the Jewish News Syndicate and the host of the Carolyn Glick Show on JNS. Carolyn, welcome back to Washington Watch.
It's always great to be with you. Thank you so much for having me on your program, Tony.
Well, I appreciate you staying up late and joining us from Israel. I want to ask you the reaction to the vice president's reiterating the support for a two-state solution, given all that is happening now and what's been happening in the last year.
You know, at JNS, we've been doing polling of Israeli sentiments regarding the presidential race, and we checked it last, I think, 2 weeks ago, and Trump was leading by more than two-thirds of Israelis supporting him over Kamala Harris. I assume that next week when we repoll that question, she'll have a much lower level of support, because what she said quite simply at the presidential debate on Tuesday night was the most hostile statement ever made by a major presidential candidate, by a nominee of one of the major parties regarding Israel in history. Her hostility towards Israel was stunning. I mean, what she said was that, you know, exactly what you're saying, that this is how they're going to pay the Palestinians back for invading Israel and carrying out the largest slaughter by terrorism of human beings, at least since 9/11, and certainly the most sadistic one in the sense that they were filming themselves in real time, carrying out atrocities against and crimes against humanity, immolating entire families in their homes. And these were crimes that were carried out by children who were along for the ride. So this was, you know, this was a very much an invasion of Palestinian society into Israel, not just Hamas, which led them, but over 10,000 people came into Israel from Gaza and participated in the atrocities, only around somewhere between 5,000 to 6,000 of whom the military estimates were actual Hamas members, card-carrying members of Hamas terrorists, and the rest of them were civilians.
Carolyn, when you look at what the vice president said, and then you look at what the Biden-Harris administration has done, I would say their support of Israel has been tepid at best. Do you see policies under a Harris administration being even more indifferent toward Israel or outright hostile?
You know, it's interesting because the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Jack Lew, gave an interview last week to a left-leaning national security think tank here in Israel. And he started off basically wagging a finger at his audience and saying, you know, look, President Biden is probably the last president that came of age and politically when, you know, everybody loved Israel. And you're going to be facing a lot of very difficult questions from Democratic leaders in the future. And it was basically just reading Israel the Riot Act and saying, you know, you don't like Biden, just wait, because the people who are replacing him, a.k.a. Kamala Harris, don't have a warm spot in their heart for Israel. And you can expect a lot more treatment of Israel along the lines that's being advocated by the anti-Semitic members of the squad of radical lawmakers in the Democratic Party, AOC, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and others. So that's what he was saying. And he was saying it in a sort of euphemistic way, but that was that underlying message was clear. And I think he's right. I think that what Kamala Harris showed at the debate this week is that an America under her presidency will not allow Israel to do anything beyond intercepting missiles en route to Israel. No offensive actions against our enemies, whether it's Iran or the Palestinians or Hezbollah, she or anybody else. She said, I will always support Israel's right to defend itself. But the United States right now continues to embargo 2,000-pound bunker buster bombs to Israel because they don't want us to take offensive action that will effectively diminish the capacities of our enemies, whether it's Hezbollah or Iran, to wage war against us with all the munitions that they're keeping in underground bunkers or in mountains, as is in the case of Iran and its nuclear installation. So what the United States is doing by withholding these 2,000-pound bunker busters is saying, you cannot actually defeat your enemy. We will only support you when, as you did on April 13th with U.S. support, where you caught the missiles, the cruise and ballistic missiles and the drones en route to Israel. That's all you're allowed to do. And that's a sucker's game because eventually enough of them get through to cause strategic damage to your country and to your people.
Carolyn, we just have about a minute and a half left. I want to go back to the issue of the two-state solution, and I like to educate our viewers and listeners. I want to put a map up there that shows what is called the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, which is the geographical heart of Israel, is the heart of Bible, the Bible land, everything we read in our Bibles, about 80% of that occurred in that area. So that small strip of the Gaza Strip, along with that big area of the West Bank, that's what they're talking about when they say a two-state solution. How could Israel defend itself if that is given away to a hostile entity?
It can't. It manifestly cannot do so. And that's the problem, is that people talk about the two-state solution as if this is some sort of a responsible policy, but it's not. What it is paving the way for a final solution. Again, the solution in both concepts is not ironic. The problem is that if you try to establish a Palestinian state, causing Israel to renounce our rights to our biblical homeland, to the homeland of the Jewish people since time immemorial, what you're saying is that you want Israel to be defeated, that you think that giving people whose goal in life is to annihilate the Jewish state and the Jewish people and all the Palestinian factions, not only Hamas, but also Fatah and the Palestinian Authority, they make no bones about the fact that they seek the annihilation of the state of Israel. You give them sovereignty over the West Bank of the Jordan, of Judea and Samaria. You are giving them the keys to the realm. You are telling them, go ahead, wipe Israel off the map.
Carolyn, we got to leave it there, but hopefully we'll catch up next week. Folks, stick with us. We're back after this.
America was a bright light until the culture gave into darkness. But we won't. We're in a battle for the soul of our nation, between right and wrong, between truth and lies. At a time when the mainstream media is blocking Americans from truth, millions are searching for a source of trustworthy news that shines a light in the darkness. At this time of great need, FRC is lighting the way forward. For 40 years, Family Research Council and its partners have stood together to advance and defend biblical truth in government and culture. Between our flagship broadcast program, Washington Watch, with Tony Perkins, to our news outlet, The Washington Stand, FRC is providing believers across the country with news they can trust from a biblical worldview. When you stand with FRC, you help light the way forward for America and the next generation. Go to frc.org/give.
If you're a young adult passionate about seeing biblical values championed in our country, check out Family Research Council's internship program. This three-month program is both a discipleship and development opportunity where you get to take part in truly meaningful work and help advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and our culture. Featuring hands-on experience, biblical worldview training, free housing, and more, this internship is a great opportunity for spiritual and professional development. Check out frc.org/internships to apply today.
As a congressman, Jody Heiss witnessed firsthand how the gradual erosion of congressional integrity has crippled America's faith in its most essential institutions. His newly released book, Sacred Trust, Election Integrity, and the Will of the People, sounds the alarm on the attempts of career bureaucrats to subvert our elections and provide solutions to make every vote count. Help preserve election integrity and order Sacred Trust today wherever books are sold.
Back to Washington Watch. Good to have you with us. The website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, in Tuesday night's presidential debate, Vice President Kamala Harris gave a rambling and incoherent statement that seemed to imply the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade had forced women to travel out of state for in vitro fertilization treatments.
Couples who pray and dream of having a family are being denied IVF treatments. What is happening in our country? Working people, working women who are working one or two jobs, who can barely afford childcare as it is, have to travel to another state to get on a plane sitting next to strangers to go and get the health care she needs. Barely can afford to do it, and what you are putting her through is unconscionable.
It remains unclear what the vice president meant by that political word salad. I mean, IVF is legal in all 50 states. And I'm not sure where the plane and the strangers came in. Well, joining me now to discuss this is Dr. Marguerite DeWayne. She is a board-certified family physician and the executive director of FACTS, the Fertility Appreciation Collaborative, to teach the Science, an organization dedicated to educating healthcare professionals and students about the scientifically valid, natural-based family planning methods. Dr. DeWayne, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, let me ask you, are you aware of any place in the country where IVF is not allowed?
No, I'm not aware that IVF is not available throughout the country. My understanding, again, I'm not a lawyer, I'm a physician, but to my knowledge, IVF is legal. But where women do need to travel extensively is to seek physicians who are trained to provide comprehensive reproductive health care through a restorative lens, one that's really designed to treat the underlying causes of infertility. And in fact, I've had patients drive 4 to 6 hours to see me to receive the kind of care that I'm trained to provide, and we currently train physicians across the country to provide. Again, care that is real women's health care that seeks to identify underlying causes of infertility and treat those through a restorative reproductive approach.
And is also respectful of human life.
Exactly. We recognize that The human life, the science shows us, in fact, that human life begins at the moment of fertilization or conception. And our goal is to help restore both men and women, their reproductive health system, so it functions normally so that they will be able to procreate naturally. Now, sometimes this does require support with medications, surgeries, and certain treatments, but the goal is to restore their health so that their reproductive system functions so that they can conceive children and bear them naturally. But again, very, very few physicians are trained in this approach to reproductive medicine, which really is an empowering approach. It really educates men and women about the reproductive system. It helps them to address a wide range of health issues, everything from painful periods to irregular cycles to premenstrual syndrome. It addresses common causes of recurrent miscarriage. I mean, Vice President Harris talked about the pain and the heartbreak of women who have experienced miscarriage. And miscarriage is a very, very common problem. And yet, as physicians, we are not trained to identify and treat modifiable risk factors of miscarriage, which is heartbreaking. And, you know, through my work, through facts about fertility, this is what we aim to do. And next week, I'll be presenting at a family medicine conference in Philadelphia on this very topic. How can we identify and treat those underlying causes that could lead to miscarriage so we can truly provide real health care to women and men?
You mentioned the miscarriages and the vice president, her comments there, suggesting that pro-life laws in various states are prohibiting doctors for treating women who show up at a hospital because of a miscarriage. Again, yes. I'm not aware of that.
And it's simply not true. And I can tell you, as a physician who cares for patients who regularly experience miscarriage, we are trained to provide both medical and surgical treatments to treat miscarriage. Now, the difference between a miscarriage and an abortion is with miscarriage, the embryo has already passed. The heart has stopped beating. The child is no longer alive. Now, women can experience what we refer to as a missed miscarriage, meaning that the embryo has died, but the pregnancy is still continuing. And sometimes that does require medication or a surgical procedure. And as physicians, it is our obligation to care for both patients, both the unborn child and the mother. And if her child has passed, if that embryo is no longer living, it is our duty and our obligation. And I can tell you, as a physician, I have had to order the medications that are sometimes used in abortion to cause an abortion. I've had to use similar medications to help treat my patients with miscarriage, and I've never been prohibited from doing so. So that's simply not true. The other thing that's important to note is this notion that, well, we need abortion because women later on in life or further along in a pregnancy may be forced to carry to term. The reality is that if a pregnancy is at risk or if the baby has already died, we can induce labor without causing an abortion, without violently destroying the unborn child. So the reality is our healthcare system, it gives us the freedom to provide true reproductive healthcare, and we do not need abortion to truly care for women.
Well, we need to have a conversation then with the vice president, because she obviously doesn't understand that.
And I'm happy to, both to address the miscarriage issue and the infertility issue, again, through a lens that restores and empowers patients to care for their fertility and reproductive health.
Yeah, the issue is it's not a big business, and that's what I think they're interested in.
That is exactly the point. Thank you.
Dr. Duane, thanks for joining us. We're out of time for today, but look forward to talking to you again soon. Folks, stick with us. We're back with more after this.
The news reflects the world we live in, but it also shapes it. Like it or not, what we learn about the world on a daily basis impacts our thinking, our worldview, and ultimately our action. So much of today's media is built on a shaky foundation that can send us hurling toward harmful ideas and hopeless solutions. Family Research Council created the Washington Stand to be a news outlet that speaks from a firm foundation, bringing you news, commentary, and analysis of what's happening in America and around the world. The Washington Stand is unapologetically biblical and uncompromisingly committed to truth. Equip yourself for the world we live in with a biblical worldview found daily at The Washington Stand. Find us at WashingtonStand.com. That's WashingtonStand.com.
America was a bright light until the culture gave into darkness. But we won't. We're in a battle for the soul of our nation, between right and wrong, between truth and lies. At a time when the mainstream media is blocking Americans from truth, millions are searching for a source of trustworthy news that shines a light in the darkness. At this time of great need, FRC is lighting the way forward. For 40 years, Family Research Council and its partners have stood together to advance and defend biblical truth in government and culture. Between our flagship broadcast program, Washington Watch, with Tony Perkins, to our news outlet, The Washington Stand, FRC is providing believers across the country with news they can trust from a biblical worldview. When you stand with FRC, you help light the way forward for America and the next generation. Go to frc.org/give.
If you're a young adult passionate about seeing biblical values championed in our country, check out Family Research Council's internship program. This three-month program is both a discipleship and development opportunity where you get to take part in truly meaningful work and help advance faith, family, and freedom in public policy and our culture. Featuring hands-on experience, biblical worldview training, free housing, and more, this internship is a great opportunity for spiritual and professional development. Check out frc.org/internships to apply today.
As a congressman, Jody Heiss witnessed firsthand how the gradual erosion of congressional integrity has crippled America's faith in its most essential institutions. His newly released book, Sacred Trust, Election Integrity, and the Will of the People, sounds the alarm on the attempts of career bureaucrats to subvert our elections and provide solutions to make every vote count. Help preserve election integrity and order Sacred Trust today wherever books are sold.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. The website, TonyPerkins.com. Coming up October the 3rd through the 6th is the Pray Vote Stand Summit right here in our nation's capital. You can find out more about the summit by going to PrayVoteStand.org. All right, I want to continue our conversation about Tuesday night's debate. So much there to cover, but I want to go back to this clip of Donald Trump. He's really pressing the issue of where the Democrats will draw the line. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is because the Associated Press actually had a story today, and this is the headline. Trump won't say whether he'd veto a national ban even as abortion remains a top election issue. Now, the whole story, let me read the first paragraph. Former President Donald Trump repeatedly declined to say during this week's debate if he would veto a national ban if he were elected again. So the whole story from the Associated Press is about Donald Trump answering a question as to whether or not he would veto a ban on abortion, which he addressed. He said it's not going to be an issue. It's not going to happen. This is going to be dealt with at the state level. But not a peep about Kamala Harris when she was pressed about this. I want to play this clip, clip 21.
And the other thing, you should ask, will she allow abortion in the 8th month, 9th month, 7th month?
Come on.
Okay, would you do that? Why don't you ask her that question?
Why don't you answer
That's
the
problem.
Question, would you
because
veto?
Under Roe v.
Answer
Wade,
the question,
you,
would
could,
you, veto?
You could do abortions in the 7th month, the 8th month, the 9th month,
not true.
And probably after birth.
No one that I've seen in the legacy media has said Kamala Harris wouldn't answer the question as to where she would draw the line on abortions. Because the reality is the Democrats don't want to draw the line. Their policy, their call for the reestablishment of Roe as the policy of the nation is abortion until birth, and in some cases after, taxpayer funding, and no pro-life laws, simply erasing most of the state pro-life laws. There clearly is a double standard, in the way the media is dealing with these candidates. But what about the debate? Well, joining me now to talk about Tuesday night's presidential debate that was hosted by ABC, which has been widely criticized by Republicans as the moderators literally took turns attempting to refute statements by former President Trump while giving the blatantly false statements made by the vice president a complete pass. Joining me now is Brett O'Donnell, former debate coach at Liberty University, now president of O'Donnell and Associates. Since 2004, he has consulted on multiple national presidential campaigns and in 2016 helped prepare seven U.S. Senate candidates to preserve the Republican majority in the Senate. Brett, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Good to be with you, Tony.
All right. Give me your top line analysis of Tuesday night's presidential debate.
Well, I thought it was actually a very poor debate. And most of the reason I thought it was a poor debate is it was poorly moderated by ABC. A debate is supposed to be between the candidates and not between the candidates and the moderator. But the moderators inserted themselves as participants rather than moderators. And they did it unfairly, in my opinion. They fact-checked Trump five times during the debate. Not once did they do that to Kamala Harris. Additionally, most of the questions sort of went like this. Donald Trump, why are you a horrible person? Kamala Harris, what do you think about Donald Trump being a horrible person? That was kind of the slant of the debate. And if you look at the question set that was asked, questions about January 6th, election interference, Trump's comments about personal comments about Kamala, they were all meant to be biased against President Trump. So I thought the debate was very, very lopsided in the way it was handled. And I thought that created a bad debate. I know some folks are going after the president for his performance, but I thought Kamala Harris was really also not very good in that debate as well. If you take a look at the very first question, was, are we better off than we were 4 years ago? Kamala Harris refused to answer that question. In my mind, that's one of the most important questions of this election. You have fully a third of Americans who can't afford to make their bills on a weekly basis, much less a monthly, yearly basis. You have credit card delinquencies that are through the roof. The economy is clearly hurting, and that's what's on folks' minds. Additionally, we have a wide open border. They never pressed Kamala Harris on her policies toward the border and why so late in the game she's decided to change her opinion on the border, really. And so I thought the fact that she didn't answer the questions, at least Donald Trump took a stab at answering the questions, I thought it was a poorly run debate.
Now, there was on one of the immigration issues, the president, former President Donald Trump, made the issue of connecting it to crime, which one of the moderators, David Muir, corrected him on. And so let's talk about for just a moment process, the role of the moderator. So as you pointed out, Kamala Harris avoided answering most of the tough questions. She just kind of sidestepped them. Is it the role of the moderator to press in and reiterate the question and press for an answer?
I think that is part of the role of the moderator. The moderator should call out candidates when they don't answer questions. They should ask questions, but they're not there to fact check. That's the job of the candidates. So when the moderators get a discussion, a debate going, they should ask a question. They should allow both candidates equal time. The question should be unbiased. It should be a question that can be answered by either candidate, not directed at one candidate or the other. And if they do that, it's going to stay more focused on policy and issues than it is on personality. The moderators in this debate made it more about persona, personality, and I thought that was unfair. And then when Kamala Harris didn't answer questions, they never said a word.
Well, it's to her benefit, actually, to make this about personality as opposed to policy. So that's probably why the moderators facilitated that. Again, talking about process, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe we've generally had a commission for presidential debates that have overseen these debates. And we usually have themed debates. One might be on foreign policy, one would be on domestic. But these debates are taking place outside. The candidates have agreed to bypass that commission. It's kind of a deregulatory move. But it might not have been the best thing, because these seem to be kind of free-for-alls based upon what the network wants as opposed to what's best for the voting public.
Well, I actually think CNN did a pretty good job of hosting their debate. The moderators didn't insert themselves. The only time they did was to say to the candidates that they had more time if they wished to further extend their answer. But for the most part, the moderators started the debate and started the discussions on each issue. I think the networks that host these should operate in conjunction with maybe some entity that takes a look at what are the top issues in the debate or in the country regarding the election, and we make sure we get questions on those issues. I mean, I can think of so many things that they really didn't delve into in depth. We didn't get an in-depth discussion of the economy. We didn't get an in-depth discussion on immigration. Those are the two top issues in this debate or in this election. And the American people were denied that for sake of 30 minutes on January 6th and was the election stolen. I really think that the networks need to take a close look and perhaps work together to come up with a set of questions that reflect what's on the minds of folks at home.
I want to move from process to actually performance here when I talk about and kind of do this objectively, looking at the two candidates. I know that's hard. I'm having a hard time with that. But to me, it looked like Kamala Harris had practiced and had really worked at a few answers, but also in stylistically. And what she was trying to project and portray to the American public. And it felt like, my observation was, she was trying to goad former President Trump into getting him off of the policies into the realm of personality.
Her performance was exactly as a lot of us had predicted. She did regular debate prep. She was off the campaign trail for almost a week. She's been off the campaign trail, by the way, for more than half of the days she's been a candidate, preparing either for the CNN interview or for this debate. And so she was very well polished. She had all of her looks down. She had her gestures down. She had her lines canned and ready to go. And as lots of us said before the debate, she needed to make this about personality and persona. She can't run on her record and she can't run on policies because she's a liberal. She's an extreme liberal. And that's out of step with the country. So she has to make this about personality. And she did exactly as predicted, which is go after Donald Trump on a personal level to try to get him angry. And quite frankly, it worked. If you watch through the debate, I think President Trump got hotter and hotter and hotter as the debate went along. Now, he was pretty disciplined about not calling her names, not looking at her, not really engaging on some of the personal attacks, but he took her bait every single time she attacked him. The most obvious example was over the rallies. The question was on immigration. She avoided the question on immigration and talked about President Trump's rallies being boring. And instead of just dismissing that attack and going full force on her on immigration, you didn't answer the question on immigration. You want to talk about my rallies. You want to talk about me because you can't talk about a wide open southern border. Donald Trump took the bait, talked about the rallies, and then pivoted over to student loans. And so that's what created a lopsided performance in some of the issues. Yet still, there's a lot of undecided voters who watched that debate who were not moved positively by her performance. Why? Because she didn't offer a specific vision and policy for the major issues that are making their lives rough right now.
I think that is underscored by the fact that she refused to answer the question about, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? because I think most Americans, I mean myself included, when you go into the grocery store and you start to buy some bacon and you got to, you know, almost, you got to go to the ATM and see what's in there so you can get some bacon. I mean, the cost of things have risen so high under the Biden-Harris administration. You mentioned some of these things and about what President Trump could have done differently. I want to go a little bit further on that because, as I mentioned at the top of this segment, you were a debate coach at Liberty University. In fact, a very winning debate coach. Liberty did quite well under your leadership there in debate. What two additional things could the president do to improve his debate performance?
So I think first and foremost, he's got to push a message through the debates. If you looked at President Trump's closing statement, he had a great message. You know, she talks about all the things that she would do, but she's had 3.5 years and hasn't done them. And in fact, the problems you're experiencing now are because of her. That's a great message to push through the debate. He's got to learn to push that consistently through the entirety of the debate, through every answer. The second thing is, every time she attacks him, he should think, how can I attack her back, rather than how do I need to answer this attack? Most of the attacks that she made against him, he could have just ignored and turned right back on offense against her and talked about how the policies that her and Joe Biden have implemented over the last 4 years are making life miserable for average Americans. And what she would do going forward would be more of the same or even worse. He's got to focus and be disciplined about staying on offense. We tell our clients all the time, there's a difference between defense and offense. Offense is being on your message and on attack against your opponent. That's how you win these debates. They're not really debates. They're messaging opportunities that are crafted. And then the final thing that he can do is the second big thing in debates is they're about moments. He needed to think about what are one or two shining moments I can have in this debate that will show my competitive advantage, my rightness, so to speak, on policy over her, and script those out and practice them. Those are the things that he could do to really improve his performance. He had a great message. He delivered it at the end. He's got to push it all the way through the debate.
Yeah, Brett, I was just thinking as you were talking about that, not taking the bait when she makes the attacks. I was thinking back to Ronald Reagan, how he would deal with those, like, well, there you go again. And just let it, like water on a duck's back, just kind of roll off and then move straight into your message and drive it and not allow that to ruffle your feathers.
That's exactly right. You know, that's exactly right. Ronald Reagan learned the art of the pivot early on in debating. George W. Bush learned it. Even Mitt Romney and others have learned the art. Clinton was a master of it. So was Obama. You've got to learn how to pivot from what they want to talk about to what you want to talk about.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you coming in, Coach, and educating us on what a good debate looks like. And hopefully others are listening as well. Good to see you, Brett.
Good to see you, Tony. Thanks for having me.
Brett O'Donnell on this edition of Washington Watch. All right, folks, that's all the time we have for today, but I want to thank you for joining us. And until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul, found in Ephesians 6, where he says, "When you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you've taken your stand, by all means, keep standing."
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com.